netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by SIDGRAPH Asia, running from November 19th to November 22nd this year in Hong Kong. FX Guide is proud to be associated with SIDGRAPH Asia and is the official podcast of the show.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Be sure to check out all of our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today is indeed a dig deep into the technical side edition, as our Mike Seymour has a conversation with Paul Kanick. Paul is technical director at Pixar with credits on Cars, Ratatouille, WALL-E, Up, Cars 2, Brave, and Monsters University. His specialty is crowd simulation, shading, and rendering, and he's been responsible for procedural animation and rendering of crowd spectacles such as the hordes of rats in Ratatouille, the deluge of falling passengers in WALL-E, and the vicious pack of talking dogs in Up. Paul is giving a course at SIGGRAPH Asia, and we are the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, so that ties in nicely, as does the fact that the new term has just started over at our sister site, fxphd.com. And we have two courses offered this term on physically-based shaders. Just a couple of the more than 100 courses on offer, including 11 new ones. The ones I'm most interested in this term? There's a DOP 218 class talking about moving the camera with Professor Ben Allen, covering all the ways to add production value to your shots by moving the camera from cranes and dollies to Steadicam and gimbals. This one looks to be a great course. There's also a Flame 303 class, which is Flame 2014 in production with Professor John Gearing. So much to learn if you're back a version or two, and a great way to jumpstart, and also to get working with other apps along with Flame, being a good citizen instead of an island. Also a class I'm thrilled to see, even though it doesn't really apply to me, Nuke for the After Effects Artist by Josh Galbancia. After Effects and Nuke interface couldn't be more different, and I often hear people from the After Effects side and from the Nuke side saying the other is so foreign to them. So this will be a great class, a way to, if you're an After Effects user, to pick up some Nuke skills and understand the difference in the user interface. And there's often many ways to accomplish the same thing, and those two interfaces couldn't be much more different, but Josh is going to take us through and give you a jump start if you're an After Effects artist looking to jump over to Nuke. So anyway, check out a whole lot of more than that I have time for here over at fxphd.com. Check out the course listing for yourself. So let's get started now. Mike Seymour interviewing Paul Kanick.
So thanks so much for joining us. We do appreciate it.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
You're giving a presentation or rather a course at SIDGRAPH in Hong Kong coming up in November. I think you're November 20, if that's not mistaken.
Exactly.
So this is physically plausible shading and lighting in Monsters University, and this is something that's of great interest, the transition that certainly Pixar has made to plausible lighting and stuff. Though before we get into that, just in your own background, you have a strong background not only in lighting, but also, I believe, in crowd simulation?
My role at Pixar back on Cars in 2004 and 2005 was shading as well as render optimization. But then starting with Ratatouille, I got very interested in crowd simulation. And actually, for a number of films on Rat, WALL-E, Up, I worked very much on the emotion of crowds. But then when I got onto my second Cars film, Cars 2, I kind of went back into the rendering and render optimization world and worked on how to render, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of cars and, you know, sort of bridge the gap between crowd motion and crowd rendering. Since then, I kind of do both. I was the crowd simulation lead on the film Brave. And actually, after that, I've been doing a lot of work on render optimization yet again, now that we're doing physically plausible shading and lighting. So I sort of wear two hats in that regard.
Actually, it's funny you should mention that before we get into the specifics of what you're doing in Hong Kong. There's a fascinating discussion we had built from some stuff we learned about how Pixar was doing Cars, and especially the distant crowd cars in terms of using basically tricks in rendering to produce one kind of deformation into a cube and then use that effectively to produce deformed cars, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we call that shrink wrapping. And and it's, to date, one of our most effective render optimizations, though it's very hard to generalize beyond Cars. But yeah, that's I essentially, what I did on Cars 2 was took the initial technique, which was originally developed on Cars 1, and kind of upgrade it and give it lots more bells and whistles.
Just want to explain that for people that that haven't read our article on it. Just it's a fascinating technique.
Yeah, absolutely. So normally, if you have a model of a car, you're talking, you know, potentially tens, hundreds of thousands of vertices. And you, if you have 100,000 of them, you know, or more, you know, that's way too much geometric description to fit in memory, as well as trace against, even with things like instancing and various optimization techniques. So since a car is almost entirely a sort of a rectangle, you know, they're convex mostly. There's very few concavities in a car. You could think of it as a rectangle or cube that has been essentially displaced or, you know, pushed and pulled and sort of sculpted into the form of a car using displacement. And that's what we've done. We essentially took a sphere, traced in to the actual car model. The length of each ray is recorded as a displacement in just a sphere map. So the very simple projection here, just spherical projection. And you can think of it as almost shrink wrapping a sphere to the shape of the car. And then when we render the actual cars, we render just them as these cubes and then do displacement to move the points into the correct shape. Now, the cool thing about this is displacement in many renderers, including RenderMan, is just done as needed. Like you dice the scene into micropolygons, you only have one per pixel, hopefully, with a bunch of cubes. So then displacement just moves just as many points as is required into place. And to take a step back, what we're actually doing is, since texture axis in a render is out of core, that is, it's not bounded by your main memory, we've essentially turned our geometry memory and made it out of core. So kind of moved off the requirement of having all the geometry in memory and just treated it like textures. So basically, yeah, we could render almost an unlimited number of cars on that film because of that. However, there's a couple big caveats. One is concavities are hard, so sucks if you're not doing cars. And two,
while it was incredibly effective, for example, it didn't do the side mirrors. It wasn't designed for close-up cars.
Exactly. That was, you know, and usually at a distance, even if we included them, you wouldn't mind. And the other is how you animate them is tricky. You know, if the cars were like really deforming, we might have to have a set of textures baked per frame for a cycle, and we didn't do it that. That would really start turning it into a data I/O nightmare after a certain point. This sort of hit a sweet spot between very little data was necessary and you can get a lot from displacement. So more work would need to be done to make it more general.
Yeah, and while it is a specific thing, I bring it up in part because I think it's a really good example of understanding that when we talk about the transition that certainly Pixar and parts of RenderMan have had over time, this idea that you know, where you are today with the possibility of having a much more ray traced approach, mm-hmm. even inside the hybrid method, the technology of ray tracing has been used for years, and it's not as if it's only used as sort of, you know, an and or option in terms of how you render. It's not as if you are sort of doing this Reeves model, and if you flip the switch, okay, then we're completely now just using ray tracing. We never were before. That process of mapping how the rays went into the cube is a great case of not ray tracing the car, but using ray tracing type technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that was back in 2005 on Cars. We were already, I mean, even Cars had plenty of ray tracing in it. It wasn't physically based. You know, it was more just for things like occlusion. But we had those operations. I think even earlier we were doing some tracing. But yeah, I mean, tracing a ray is a great way of measuring something in a scene.
Yeah.
You know, it could be for lighting or it could be for other purposes like effects. One example that I like of using displacement is if you're, you know, doing a procedural texture and you like want to make something melt and you want to make it, you know, avoid going over the floor. You know, you're just ray tracing to the floor. You know, there's lots of ray tracing all over graphics. So Houdini's got plenty of those ray nodes, you know, for figuring out where things are.
So in your presentation that you're giving, you're doing a bit of a history that brings us up to the present day, which must cover from the original Reeve stuff through, well, I guess there's sort of this three period that sometimes is talked about, the sort of period I think in your paper is Toy Story, the original one, up to Incredibles, and then a second bracket from Cars to Brave, and then this newer physically plausible shading and lighting model that has come into being around Monsters University. Do you want to just touch on that idea of these kind of not hard and fast, but sort of three distinctive phases?
Sure. Yeah, I guess from Toy Story through Incredibles, which admittedly is the phase I know least about because I was an intern at Pixar when Incredibles was being finished. Admittedly, I know less about that, but primarily we were using RenderMan as it was originally designed, using the Reyes algorithm, which is rasterization, and which means, you know, everything that's in your scene, that's in camera, you dice it up to as many micropolygons as is necessary, throw away the rest, and you could actually get some very high complexity of scenes because once you're done rendering a chunk of the scene, like a little bucket, you could forget about that and you could just keep going. So if you could render one part, you could kind of render the whole part. And we sort of could plodder on adding complexity and complexity. And Nemo is like, you know, has some really elaborate choral sets that kind of take advantage of that. The problem is by sticking to strict rasterization, you don't get as many of the realistic lighting effects for free. I mean, you still can get them. We use shatter maps and very interesting techniques to sort of fake subsurface scattering on Nemo. But it was a lot of work to do that, and we were sort of missing out on potentially some of those, such that by the time we got to Cars, we added ray tracing into our toolkit. And once we did that, we actually lost some of the benefits of rasters, of pure rays, because we no longer could forget about the stuff we've already rendered. It might still need to be around in memory when we cast a ray that might go to that other part of the scene. Note that it's not the benefit of rays isn't just for the memory savings. It was also for the motion blur and displacement and depth of field. And that benefit we've kept throughout the whole time. But we lost, in order to get more realistic lighting from Cars forward, we sort of lost some of the memory benefits. So there was a big scramble on Cars with render optimization. And at that point on, it was sort of a hybrid technique. You know, we were using some ray tracing, point-based global illumination and occlusion became very popular around Wally and Up. And actually, that was around when Pirates of the Caribbean and stuff with Davy Jones with like all that detail. You know, ILM was doing this stuff too, Sony, and like, you know, point-based techniques got very big. But it was a really hybrid toolkit.
Yeah, extensive use of brick maps in Wally, for example.
Absolutely, absolutely. So brick maps. So one of the ways we got reflection to be very quick on Wally as well as Ratatouille is we raster or rather voxelize the world into a brick map, ray trace the real geometry with a very few number of rays. But since a brick map is a sort of a volumetric version of the world that's mipmapped, you can do blurs on it really easily. So we rather than getting blurry reflections by shooting more rays and average them, we traced into a blurry world. So what we're reflecting was already blurry. And we called that trace radiance. And yeah, that was a technique that we've used for years, probably I'd say from Ratatouille through Brave even was when that technique was used a lot. Which kind of brings us to the more the current state of the art. Starting with Monsters University and forward, the folk in Seattle who make a RenderMan, Pixar, but you know our team up there, essentially took that idea and made it part of the renderer itself, something called the Radiosity Cache, which essentially rather than having a pre-pass where you voxelize a version of the world into a brick map, it sort of builds it on the fly while you're rendering so that if you've already shaded a point, you have that actually at a number of levels of detail such that by the time another ray goes there or near there, you might not need to reshade it. You can just look up into this radiosity cache, which is a big aspect of the win we were getting from this kind of homebrew trace radiance technique. The radiosity cache let us do indirect illumination really quickly. And then all of a sudden we started thinking, if we don't need to do all these passes anymore, perhaps, you know, we could just do like, you know, the single passing and just sort of obey the law of physics at every level and see if we can get, you know, more realistic lighting with fewer knob tweaks and such. And that sort of led us down the road of physically based lighting and shading, where we've kind of are moving away from the multiple passes that were critical in the past for render optimization. Now that the a lot of those techniques we had developed kind of as needed in the past were part of the renderer proper, we've actually been trying to simplify our pipeline a bit using these techniques and hopefully make better looking images, you know, as a result. So the other promise is interactive feedback as you're rendering. As you know, as many people know with multi-pass techniques, to get like a couple of final pixels, you might need several passes that need to be regenerated previously. Whereas when you do a single pass physically based render, it's just the pixels start dropping in immediately when you hit render. So it's easier to make kind of coarse level changes and get continuous feedback without rerunning passes that might need to change.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in terms of that. And I guess to just put it in context for somebody just in terms of lights, and I think an example, we had an interview with Christoph Henry at Pixar around the time MU came out. And I think it was in that discussion, there was this whole idea, well, some scenes had like 300 lights in them, and that would reduced down to maybe an overall global illumination kind of dome HDRI and a couple of lights, and thus dramatically reducing the complexity at the artist lighting level.
Yeah, I guess in particular that indirect diffuse is where the number of lights have dropped dramatically. We often, for things like bounce and fill lights, even with ray tracing in the past, we used many small light sources to kind of fill in and sculpt the look, which was really kind of compensating for the lack of indirect diffuse. We found just by, you know, doing that extra bounce and diffuse lighting, we got a lot of that fill for free and get to eliminate a lot of lights and components of lights. Yeah, and definitely a dome light in general. In the, you know, the classic way of doing environment lighting, you don't really get accurate shadowing from it. It's more like, you know, you get the diffuse color and you darken it with ambient occlusion and maybe reflection occlusion as well if you're reflecting it. But now essentially a dome light is sort of an approximation as if you had many thousands of point lights, you know, the way you're sampling it. And you do get good shadows from dome lighting now, which has eliminated the need for lots of these other lights we're putting in the scene. So I do have a slide in my talk where I show the number of lights in a scene in Toy Story 3, and it's just going to blow everyone's mind because there's just so many of them. A lot of them, like individual characters, have their own lighting rigs that they bring in with them. And by the time you combine that with the set lights, you have way so much complexity. Where we can compare it to a similar thing done today, yeah, usually it's more like tens of lights as opposed to before. There, there might have been 100 or more as kind of an average.
So that discussion and certainly the title of the course is really interesting in terms of coming up to this idea of using much more physically accurate lighting and shading. But there's a part of the course, if you actually sort of read the detailed description of the course, in terms of pattern generation for the shading.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering if we could talk about that, because I haven't heard so much about that, and it seemed fascinating.
Yeah, this is actually, I feel like, kind of an underserved area.
Yeah, I agree.
In terms of talks at SIGGRAPH and such. And part of it is, I teach a course at the Academy of Art University on shading and rendering. And the students are also always asking, how do you shade at Pixar? And it seems like this information isn't really out there. And, you know, just the kind of, like, do you UV map everything? Do you use projection paint? Just people don't know. And I feel like we've talked about it, but not really in one place. Like, these are the ways we generate patterns. So I guess real quickly to go over them, we do, for sets at least, do a fair bit of proceduralism, you know, noise and fractals and such. But very rarely is that the pure pattern. More often than not, most of our models and sets will start off with some common signals like baked occlusion and baked curvature. So we'll already have some maps that are auto-generated that we'll then use to modulate things like noise. But in addition to that, we do a ton of what we call rounded cube mapping, we'll have like maybe a 2K or 1K tiling black and white pattern that doesn't look highly detailed. You know, it's not like a photograph we've taken. It's kind of like a hand-painted sort of type of pattern, maybe bubbles, cracks, whatnot. And we'll project, we'll essentially use the normal of the object to choose, basically, it's like a cube mapping, but you blend between a projection along the three axes based on the normal. I think, I'm not sure what people call it overall. We call it rounded cube mapping, but it's like cube mapping, but it's got a fuzzy edge.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll use that to essentially take these big textures and just treat them as procedural patterns. And for sets, we can go a long way with baked occlusion, baked curvature, noise, and rounded cube mapped tiling textures. And all that stuff can be done without, you know, painting anything. There's, you know, it's just kind of tuning parameters and wiring up nodes together in a program called Slim, which is a way of constructing RenderMan shaders visually. And this is something that's just off the shelf on RenderMan Studio.
Yep.
We just have a bunch of our own nodes for it. And that's actually how a lot of our shading, at least, you know, for sets gets done. But we're definitely not only procedural. I know sometimes we get a reputation for that, but we do a hell of a lot of painting too. We've traditionally had a system called Picasso for setting up a camera that has a view of your model, kind of rendering it and painting over that, using it as a pass. That's sort of going out of favor now. More and more people are using Mari, which is... who makes that again? The Foundry, right?
Yeah. And is this to assume that we've gone to a P-Text pipeline?
So, yeah, oh, that's a very interesting question. We do use P-Text, but not exclusively.
Okay.
So very often those signals I talked about before, like baked occlusion, baked curvature, we bake into P-Text. The reason is because we're doing that baking long before we have UVs or anything on objects, or even before the modeling is complete. And P-Text is kind of... UV independent, so it's very easy to kind of bake signals into that format. Now, in terms of Mari, I'm not exactly sure if Mari has full P-Text support. We might still use UVs there, but we know we want to move in that direction.
Yeah, Mari does have a P-Text. It came originally as UV when it was down in Weta, but certainly when it went to the Foundry, it became a P-Text valid option.
Okay. I need to check up with that. Actually, the other guy I'm giving a talk with, Davide, is working on that pipeline right now.
Okay.
So he may have a little more information on that. But, I mean, we do use P-Text. We use Mari for painting. And we often, you know, we have some other tricks. Oh, a lot of coordinate systems that we set up just to project things, as well as Davide is going to talk about some interesting techniques where he was using... essentially like a, I'm not sure, it wasn't Houdini exactly, but an external package to sort of scatter points randomly on the scene and use those as coordinate systems to, say, put knots in a tree. We also use texture synthesis now and then to sort of take a vector field over an object and synthesize a texture directionally, which is useful for getting, say, bark that flows over the length of a tree.
Right.
Rather than just like, you know, tiling spatially evenly or having to UV map the tree, which I've UV mapped trees. It's not that bad, but we have some ways to do directional texture synthesis that we did with collaboration with Disney. I believe it's actually a Disney tool. But in general, though, it's sort of a hybrid of proceduralism and texture painting. And it's really interesting to talk to other studios and other people about this because, you know, there's some like Blue Sky, which are like really gung-ho on proceduralism, but a lot of people are just painting textures these days, and they feel are missing out on a lot of the kind of free shading you can get just from signals like occlusion and curvature that every model natively has. You just need to measure it and bake it out, as well as, you know, all the classic techniques of using, you know, wavelet noise and just tiling projected textures.
There's one other tool that a bit like our original discussion earlier in this conversation about that, you know, nexus between different sort of departments. There's another one that I heard about in terms of something Montes University, because this was a, you know, major film using physically based lighting and shading. There was the idea, well, let's grab some models and we'll stick some HDRs on a on a dome, and we'll have a look at how that plays out. Even though, of course, it's a fully animated film, we'll just stick some live action HDRs in there to get us going. And apparently, from what I understand, that was quite popular. And then it got to a point that is it Splat that allows somebody to actually paint over a?
I should have. Yeah, that's one of our new lighting tools that we have. Is we can act. Yeah, we can start with an HDR image. More often than not, we start with a simple, like, painted gradient, you know, not necessarily like a realistic scene of a city or something like that. And we'll do things like we'll have tools that geometrically allow an artist to place a light source, but then at render time, it gets splatted into the dome.
Right.
So, for instance, like with a sun, yeah, the user, for them, it seems like they just have a regular direction light that they're moving around. But when they render it, yeah, we do a quick splat. We call that light paint, I believe.
Oh, okay. Because it seems to me that that was like, you know, it sort of felt like it was something that might be something that texturing would use and turned on its head and given over to the lighting department is a completely different approach, that idea of being able to effectively paint your environment.
Yeah, no, this came about, I think, more when we started really liking dome lights. Lighters were just like, all right, we want more control. But in terms of doing splatting and texturing, more often than not, our shaders remain, you know, fairly procedural. You know, like if we needed to combine, let's say, like, you know, like one image with another or one splat with like another image, we would just do the layering, you know, as part of our shader. We wouldn't need to have to like recreate a new one. Whereas we actually are, I think, generating a new EXR. With light paint set on the fly. But it's a similar idea, though, in that there is, I guess, that is a little proceduralism in lighting, you know, to combine several sources like that, create a new one.
Yeah, because it's an interesting problem if somebody's working on, say, the texturing and patterns of, say, Dean Hardscrabble. I mean, that's going to look different in a different lighting setup. And because we're getting so much from the lighting setup and you're not sort of baking that into the textures, as it were, it's important, I guess, to have that be able to be previewed and viewed in a number of different lighting scenarios.
Yeah. So I guess one way we sort of can get that consistency is we often create early on in a show a bunch of standard lighting rigs. We call them shader lights because they're lighting, it's lighting for shader, but we'll have nighttime, daytime, neutral, you know, we'll tend to create a couple of those, and they're definitely reliant on domes, and I don't think we actually splat like the real environment, but it'll be similar. But yeah, that's always an ongoing issue, is how to get a better and better preview of what it will finally look, but shading in context, something we always try to do, and is, you know, there's still work to be done in that area for sure.
So the last part of your talk is devoted to shader interoperability and render optimizations. I was wondering if that shader interoperability, I just don't think of Pixar as needing to sort of share its models or its textures that much. What are you referring to there when you talk about interoperability?
Oh. Okay, so this is actually part that I've worked on more recently. And what I mean by that is oftentimes we do our shading, you know, in Slim, get a RenderMan shader, but believe it or not, don't have a good way to see that texture when you're animating it. You know, in our proprietary software Presto, but let's say you're animating in Maya, same deal. Like, we wouldn't be able to see that RenderMan shader, which is highly procedural in the ways I described earlier. We don't actually see that texture there. So that's actually the first thing. And this is a little embarrassing. You know, texture mapped models in Maya has been around since the beginning. But essentially, it's a way to bake out your BRDF inputs, so that you could see that, you know, in Maya or in Presto, as well as potentially use the same BRDFs in the preview. Let's say, for instance, you had a metallic character. You might want, you know, a microfacet BRDF, something like that. So it's those inputs might be different than, say, the inputs for a Fong specular. So it's a way of sort of baking BRDF inputs. Another thing is, you know, let's say we want to do stuff in Houdini. We do a lot of effects in Houdini, and we also might want to see the shading in Houdini as well. So it's that's one aspect, is being able to see it there. And then there's also just the pure render optimization aspect. You know, proceduralism is great, but it's often highly dependent on the topology of the model. And if you want to start doing things like LOD, where you swap out cheaper versions, maybe even decimate on the fly, if you want to get fancy, shaders are the first thing to break, long before other things. You know, you might, your UVs might get scrambled if you're using PTEX. That's very brittle. If you're doing something based on primvars, you know, like vertex weights that you've painted, that will get scrambled potentially. So one of the things I want to emphasize with shader interoperability is the ways you bake out your BRDF inputs may be more or less robust when you start messing with the topology, like for LOD. And I wanted to point out the sort of benefits of actually of spatial data structures like brick maps to preserving shading that is robust to sort of LOD. So you might really hack up your model, maybe even combine GPRIMs, things like that. But as long as you have a correlation to like the original spatial data, like normally when you decimate, what you're trying to preserve is the shape overall. And if that overall shape is what you're using to read your texture values, then you're good. Your shading will stick. So we actually use that a bit on Monsters University for the crowds, which tend to be, you know, models for up close. You don't have enough time to make different versions of it, especially because the shading broke. I sort of, when I was after Brave, I started exploring render optimization quite a bit and level of detail. And one of the things I wanted to figure out was how to get the shaders not to break for level of detail. So that is when I started working on how to bake out BRDFs and explore the various formats, brick maps, PTEX, UV textures, vertex colors, and figure out what are the pros and cons of each. And that's one of the things I'm going to list, is what all these formats can do for you. So I'll be talking a bit about brick maps in terms of they're good for LED, but also talk about their limitations. Coincident surfaces, for instance, and how things like PTEX can help. And anyway, there's a lot of detail there. I don't want to go overboard on this topic, but a lot of it is for render optimization. And I guess in terms of targeting other platforms, even though in Pixar, yeah, it's like we're ultimately always authoring our shaders for RenderMan and using it in RenderMan, we have a lot of third-party tools, Maya, Houdini.
Mari, yeah.
Mari, exactly, you know, and potentially more in the future. That's one thing is we have to be very aware that the current pipeline, you know, this changes all the time. So this is not going to be the last time we need to get our shaders out of RenderMan and into another package.
So one of the things that really set the house on fire at SIDGRAPH in Los Angeles was Pixar's preview, I guess, a technological kind of look rather than any kind of release of uses with Katana. And obviously Katana's a lighting tool. I'm just wondering, is that going to factor into any of your talk?
Absolutely. One of the things we showed, I just want to make sure, are you referring to the demo at the NVIDIA booth?
I am, yeah.
I'm asked that. Yeah, yes. So it definitely factors in because it's using a rendering system. So this is not so much Katana specific, but that interactive lighting we were doing where it basically looked like a final lit shot in MU, but it was rendering interactively. That was using a framework called Optics by NVIDIA. And that is not, you can't just get a RenderMan shader to run in Optics. It's very limited what you can render in the GPU. So the way we got the shaders out of RenderMan into that is using the shader interoperability technique. So in particular, we got a pipeline for getting PTEX into there. So I definitely will be showing some of that footage again. And ultimately, you know, that is technology that's under development. We did not actually use it for Monsters. That was just a test to show how it would work. But ultimately, we do want to run with that technique. And the shader interoperability work that I'll be showing is going to be how we feed that pipeline.
Yeah, and if I think I remember correctly, Katana was used on Blue Umbrella. We've talked a lot about MU because obviously it's the big feature, but the short film Blue Umbrella also adopted a lot of the points that we've been talking about, and as is the case with your short films, is a great place for you guys kind of using as a proof of concept testing of both creative stuff, but, you know, technical stuff.
Yeah. So I didn't answer the Katana question earlier. Let me talk more about that. So we did use Katana on Blue Umbrella, not yet Monsters. And right now we currently are using lighting software that we've written in-house, But, you know, that's actually first was released. It's called Lumos in 2005. And we're sort of looking ahead. And, you know, we've always felt that, you know, if there's a third-party tool that can sort of match what we do and, you know, we don't have to have engineers working on it, you know, we might want to move in that direction. And so we evaluated Katana on the Blue Umbrella. And there definitely was some hurdles. We've had to work with the foundry a bit to figure out what the limitations are and how to overcome them. But ultimately, I believe this has been announced, or like we are, you know, moving forward to work with the foundry to continue to explore use in future films.
Well, for example, certainly what was announced at SIDGRAPH, and we did some stuff with both Pixar and the foundry on this, is that Katana is shipping with RenderMan licenses. And so clearly, if somebody was looking at Katana, and your work and your presentation at SIDGRAPH would be a great, part of their getting up to speed on that, because clearly Katana users will be using RenderMan.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess the Blue Umbrella will definitely have some elements on that. And yeah, I mean, just offhand, you know, I've only used Katana a little bit, but often what we do, many studios who use various renderers, including RenderMan, you end up writing these little scripts that post-process your scene before you send it to the renderer. Mm-hmm. Maybe it invises things, it filters it. We call them riff filters in RenderMan.
Call them what, sir?
And they're often... What's that?
What do you call them?
Riff filters.
All right. So is this the sort of thing that would check whether something was manifold so it would render or not, like for models and stuff? Or?
Oh, this might be things that like, oh, remove shaders from these and replace it with another one.
Okay.
You know, like change the number of sand. It's just like a way to kind of just in time alter your scene before you render.
Yeah.
And you know, manipulate it in various ways. And we started creating tons and tons of these. And they're just lists of either written in Python or C++. And what... You know, as a chain of scripts, it was really hard to manage what was affecting what. But in Katana, you could do those same operations, but you actually have a node graph. Like, it's very clear what is affecting what, how the data is flowing. And most of those operations that we were doing in riff filters, we found could be done either natively in Katana, or Katana could easily be extended to do that. So we thought that this approach was both more intuitive and more easy to maintain in the future. And yeah, so like we think that Katana is actually a good way to go. One of the big limitations, I think, for us, I mean, it's not too bad, but I'm teaching the Academy of Art. I don't think they have it for anything but Linux yet. So it's actually hard for me to teach it outside of work. But, I feel like this could be big. And I'm looking forward, hopefully, to be able to like, you know, it's kind of like a pipeline in a box, sort of, you know, and like a lot of, especially like, you know, people that aren't in bigger companies, it's hard for them to really grasp what the bigger studios are doing, I think, you know, in terms of their rendering pipelines. And I think Katana will be a great way to potentially bridge that gap. And I don't know, it'll hopefully make our pipeline a little less custom, a little more maintainable and more easily extensible. Like that, what Danny was showing at the NVIDIA booth was using Katana to sort of like host that viewer.
Yeah.
For NVIDIA optics. And, you know, so far it seemed that Katana was actually a great way to plug those two technologies together.
Yeah. And as you say, that was not a release of anything. It was more a technology showing. But I think you even caught the foundry guys off guard with that one. So let's get back to your course. And I just want to discuss the audience, if someone was listening to this, you know, which is aimed at, which is really you're aimed at somebody that understands a lot of the terms, but maybe, mm-hmm. So it's not a beginner level course, but it's also not a hardcore coding course, is it?
Yeah, I don't think there will be very much math at all in my course, and that, you know, like some SIGGRAPH talks can get bogged down in, you know, a lot of equations, and then you kind of tune out after that. This won't be one of those, but that being said, I'll be drawing from lots of examples from production, and I might unfortunately drop terms like PTEX and BrickMap too often. So hopefully people will stop me if I go too quick. But it will be very much a sort of peer-to-peer talk, in that like it'll be about rendering pipeline and shading pipeline for people that work with rendering and shading and lighting. So hopefully, you know, we're kind of bringing our experience from Pixar, but we hope that we can get a lot of interaction with the audience and them to share their experiences. And, you know, I'm sure hopefully we'll all learn a lot, because I think, like I mentioned earlier, you know, not a lot of people know how we necessarily shade and light up Pixar. And I'm hoping to kind of get that info out there and sort of in broad strokes show how it's evolved over the years. And hopefully, you know, we can learn from others, you know, what sort of decisions they're making and what problems they're facing. And yeah, I don't know. I hope people will get something from it.
So now the conference is on from the 19th to the 22nd. Your talk is actually on the 20th, the middle of the conference, which is Wednesday afternoon at, I believe, 2:15. Though details of that, of course, are up on the SIDGRAPH Asia 2013 website. And presumably Pixar, as in the past, will be there in another capacity. Certainly the Renderman team has been at past SIDGRAPH Asias and doing good stuff. So
yeah, we always kind of tag team it. You know, the Renderman team goes, and there's usually a few people from production. That just we talk about what we've worked on lately. And I think the big news, Blue Umbrella at Monsters University, is the way we shade in light seems to be catching some attention. So
yeah,
kind of perhaps a timely coincidence about us all going there at once.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to run through. I'm certainly going to be sitting in the audience taking notes, looking forward to it.
Oh, very cool. You're going to be there. Awesome. Yeah. Feel free to ask questions during the talk, because it's always awkward if, like, you give this whole presentation, like, any questions, and then, like, you know. So, yeah, feel free to ask questions. And, yeah, also if you have any more questions, you know, on these topics. I know I just kind of ran with it, with a lot of these technical topics, but I don't know. It sounds like you know more than I do with the Katana stuff. So.
And you just want to give a quick shout out to who's presenting with you, right? Because it's two of you presenting.
Oh, yeah. So this is Davide Passari is my co-presenter. And he will be talking a lot about the Mari integration that, unfortunately, I didn't know perhaps as much as I should on that. As well as he's going to be talking about... he's done a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of actually implementing the new physically-based illumination pipeline on Monsters University. I was sort of exploring more of the render optimization details and the shader interoperability bit, as well as I worked on the older sort of pipeline. So Davide will bring with him a lot of the nitty-gritty pipeline details. So if you know people in the audience have questions, like how exactly did you factor your light shaders from your co-shaders in the system? He'd be the guy to answer, because really, he's the one that did the work. I'm just sort of taking some of the credit.
Well, thank you so much for this, and I'll see you in Hong Kong.
Oh, very cool. Great. Well, I'm glad. Good chatting, and yeah, I'll see you there.
Well, as I said at the beginning, we are the official podcast of SIDGRAPH Asia, and we have more written stories coming up. Plus, there's one already online at fxguide.com about extracting editable objects from a single photo. It's really cool stuff. Check it out. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, check out all the new course lineup over at fxphd.com, where the new term is just starting. Well, you've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. Also, check out our high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. That'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.